Good jobs numbers are great for all of America. Could tiny homes be a solution to economic woes? A bailout that was done well. And what happened to the JetBlue Spirit merger? Welcome back to the Weekly Money Clip. In a market with millions of podcasts, it is tough to stay on top of the essential business and tech stories beyond headlines. This week, we will be counting down five key moments from last week to give you context for the week ahead. As always, clips are under 5 minutes from voices you trust, adding context to headlines from the week behind to prepare you for the week ahead. Before we jump in, let's review the week's top headlines. In this week's business scene, the Federal Reserve held the spotlight, casting a shadow of anticipation across financial markets. A recent report underlines a robust job market in February, hinting at an economy vibrant with employment, yet a potential cooling phase. This delicate balance between growth and moderation might just be the catalyst the Fed needs to steer its inflation battle without hastening to slash interest rates. Meanwhile, in the realm of technology, several stories led headlines. Microsoft raised alarms over renewed breaches by Russian state-sponsored hackers, a digital skirmish that underscores the ongoing cyber Cold War. Nvidia, on the other hand, is inching closer to dethroning Apple. As the second most valuable company, a testament to the burgeoning influence and financial might of AI and chipmakers. The currency of the digital age, Bitcoin, briefly soared to a record high, breaching the $70,000 mark. This surge reflects a growing confidence, or perhaps speculative fervor, in the cryptocurrency market, a realm where digital gold promises riches to those who dare to dream. From the depths of the South China Sea, China made waves with the discovery of a 100 million ton oil field, a significant boost to the nation's energy reserves. And not far behind, Gulf oil titans Saudi Aramco and ADNOC have set their sights on lithium, signaling a strategic pivot towards the critical component of the green energy revolution. Those were the key headlines. Now, let's dive into the stories behind the headlines. This week, we welcome Scott Stantis, Jennifer Horn, Simpson Garfinkel, and Jake Novak to the Money Clip. Let's join them now.
At number five in our countdown, we begin with Scott Stantis reviewing a strong jobs numbers report and the fallout. Scott is an internationally syndicated editorial cartoonist, senior fellow at the Alabama Policy Institute, and co-host of DMZ America podcast. The latest employment figures show job creation at over 220,000 in February, but revisions may be on the horizon. According to Scott Stantis at CenterClip, recent adjustments by the government have lowered initial estimates for job growth in December and January. Economists warn that the job market may not be as strong as perceived, despite ongoing job growth and consumer confidence. Stantis suggests that slight interest rate increases by the Federal Reserve may stimulate further job creation, benefiting American workers. He also says the present economic climate is favorable for job seekers and employees looking to secure higher salaries. Here is the entire analysis from Scott.
So the new employment numbers are out and they're very, very good. Will they stay that way? That remains to be seen. I'm editorial cartoonist Scott Stantis coming to you from the right for CenterClip. Well, the new numbers came out for February and there is over 220,000 new jobs created. Why am I suspicious or why am I saying let's wait and see if those are the actual numbers? Well, for the two previous months to that, and I'm going to be quoting Market Watch right now, a story by Jeffrey Bartash. He states that the government lowered its estimated new jobs created in January to 229,000 from the initial 353,000. The previous 333,000 increase in jobs in December was also chopped down to 290,000. Altogether, some 167,000 fewer new jobs were created in January and December than previously reported. Now, we could go into a long detail of why this happened, but it pretty much has something to do with getting estimates and then reaffirming or confirming those numbers. This isn't unusual, but it's unusual for it to happen so often. Many economists look at this and say, well, that means the job market is a lot softer than we initially thought. Well, that's partially true. My spin, you're still looking at 250,000 jobs created per month, and that's pretty substantial. We're looking at coming very close to full employment, as we define it here in the United States, and that's a good thing. The economy continues to grow, consumer confidence continues to be strong, people are buying things, and they have jobs in which to buy them. Now, what we would like to see from my perspective, is the Federal Reserve finally looking at high employment as a good thing, not a bad thing, lowering even nominally the interest rates to ignite even more heat in the economy, create more jobs. And what would that do? Why is this a good thing? Because then it creates competition for jobs, and competition is what raises prices, and we'll also raise income, we'll raise salaries. This is obviously a very, very good thing for the American worker, and it's going to be very interesting to watch how the Federal Reserve responds to this, how the markets respond to it, how inflation pressures respond to it. My guess is the inflation is not going to be significantly impacted by it. So, way to go, America. Way to go, jobs. If you're unemployed, go out and get yourself a job. If you're already employed, go ask for more money. For Center Clip, I'm Scott Stanis.
We now continue the countdown with number 4. We join Jennifer Horn. Jennifer is the host of Is It Just Me or Have We All Lost Our Minds? She can be seen on CNN, MSNBC, Fox, CNN Max, / Scripps, News Nation, USA Today, and others. In this segment, Jennifer Horn delves into the fascinating world of tiny homes. With a surge in popularity, these dwellings under 600 square feet are capturing the interest of a diverse range of individuals. Despite being perceived as a real estate fad, recent research points towards a 5% growth prospect in the market by 2027. Interestingly, 40% of tiny homeowners are over 50 years old, seeking to downsize and reduce expenses as they approach retirement. Surprisingly, these homeowners tend to have more savings than the average American, with 68% owning their tiny homes mortgage-free. Embodying adaptability and resourcefulness, the rise of tiny homes reflects a growing trend towards simplicity and sustainability in today's society. What is the full outlook? Here's the segment from Jennifer.
Hi, this is Jennifer Horn, host of Is It Just Me or Have We All Lost Our Minds? Coming to you today on Center Clip. And I just want to talk about something that's, you know, not necessarily the top news item of the day or anything, but that I'm just fascinated by lately. And that's all these tiny homes. You know, I watch some of the HGTV shows on it. I read about them. I look at pictures of them and I'm fascinated by them. I find it the coziness, the adorableness of them to be very appealing. And the idea of the kind of escaping to my own small space, the privacy. And I imagine that that's probably in part because I am one of 10 children. I grew up in a crowded house. I had 5 children. I have 6 grandchildren. I guess I'm always feeling like I'm a little bit crowded, but there's just something really appealing about them. And it makes me wonder about the market for them. Who are these people? Who's living in these tiny houses full time? And so I did some research and I just felt like sharing it with you tonight because I think it's really interesting. A tiny home is defined as any single family dwelling of 600 square feet or less. Downsize.com is this website that says that there are about 10,000 tiny homes in the United States. And on average, they're about 225 square feet. Not only is that 10 times smaller than the average house, that's smaller than a lot of hotel rooms. So I read this article that just today that got me going on this topic again. And it was suggesting that these tiny homes are a fad, a real estate fad. But I don't think so. I think the article has missed the mark because of the growing popularity of tiny homes. And what I've learned in my research is that the tiny home market is actually growing and it's poised for almost 5% growth between now and 2027. And in real estate market terms, that's significant. They only cost, on average, of course, there's always a spectrum, about $67,000, which if you've bought a house lately, you know, is much less expensive. On average, you know, homes, that's about 86% less than the average home price. And they're environmentally friendly. And this is something I'm really kind of drawn to. They consume fewer resources to produce them, to maintain them. They, you know, for example, they only produce 2,000 pounds of CO2 emissions annually, and that's compared to about 28,000 pounds of an average size home. They only use about 7% of the energy of an average house in the United States of America. But when I'm trying to kind of analyze whether or not they are a fad or a trend, you know, the durability of the home market. These are the numbers that really impressed me. 40% of tiny homes are owned by people over the age of 50 who are looking to downsize space and expenses and trying to live a simpler life as they approach retirement. It's, you know, and that's me. So maybe that's why I'm drawn to it. But the lifestyle actually kind of has shown cross-generational appeal. 40% of the people who own these houses are between the ages of 30 and 50, and then the other 20% are under the age of 30. That's fascinating to me. I can't imagine living in such a small space, and yet at the same time, across generations, people are being drawn to this. So tiny homes are people who own tiny homes have more money in their savings account than most Americans. 68% of tiny homeowners have no mortgage. These homes are more environmentally friendly. They have cross-generational appeal. From my perspective, it's just really cool and fascinating to watch how effectively and creatively people come up with solutions to the challenges that they face and answers to some of the challenges that we face societally. So I just love what they represent. You know, that kind of that can-do human spirit, making good and making comfort and peace if in your life, whatever your life is, finding an answer to some of those problems and living peacefully within your own space. So I think they're cool. And I just wanted to share some of that information with you. So thanks for listening.
Welcome back to number 3 in our weekly countdown. Again, with Scott Stantis presenting an analysis on the New York Community Bank Corp bailout. The U.S. banking system saw a positive turn with New York Community Bank Corp, aided by Liberty Strategic Capital, Hudson Bay Capital, and Reverence Capital Partners, injecting $1 billion in cash to prevent collapse. Led by former Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, Liberty Strategic Capital's bailout offers a lifeline to NYCB, avoiding government intervention. This move follows a similar fate of Silicon Bank, highlighting NYCB's overinvestment vulnerability. NYCB now boasts new management and investor board members, promising a more resilient future. Stantis applauds the market-driven rescue, opposing government bailouts, and promoting creative destruction to uphold a competitive marketplace. This whirlwind saga concludes with NYCB's survival, steering towards more secure waters with investor guidance. Let's join Scott now for his full op-ed.
The U.S. banking system was met with some very good news, right on the heels of some very bad news. I'm editorial cartoonist Scott Stantis for Money Clip. Well, NYCB, that's the New York Community Bancorp, was really struggling. It was on the precipice of catastrophe. Its stocks had plummeted down to junk bond levels. Happily for them, Liberty Strategic Capital, Hudson Bay Capital, and Reverence Capital Partners all stepped forward and infusing it with $1 billion in cash. If you recognize Liberty Strategic, that's run by Mnuchin, who is a former Treasury Secretary. This is great news. No one likes to see banks fail, and this particular failure reminds me very much of Silicon Bank as well. So what happened? Well, it looks like NYCB really had an exposed position, particularly when it came to business real estate and office real estate. It overinvested. And frankly, there were a lot of us who said, that's nuts, and could have told them that if they'd bothered to ask us. Well, now there's new management at NYCB. There's a new CEO, and the four investors are going to be sitting on the board. So there's going to be sobriety and common sense. It looks like NYCB is going to make it. But again, no government money was needed. I don't care for government bailouts, and I'll tell you why. Because businesses have a right to succeed at crazy levels, but they also have a right to fail. Destructive, creative destruction is how markets work. So in this instance, as I'm reading the analysis, these people who went in and gave them this large cash infusion, it's probably a pretty good investment, and they will be able to right this ship moving forward. But in businesses that had terrible business plans, that just didn't offer a product that consumers wanted to consume, all of that leads me to believe the marketplace, as ugly and brutal as it can be, should be left to its own devices. And that is exactly what happened here. NYCB lives to fight another day. and the government kept the hell out of it. For Money Clip, I'm Scott Stannis.
At number two this week, we address the comeback of analog computing. Simpson Garfinkel is a science journalist who has published hundreds of articles in newspapers and magazines and 17 books. Research interests broadly include data science ethics, digital forensics, personal information management, counterintelligence, and counterterrorism. He is currently chief scientist, Basis Tech LLC. Here, Simpson is reporting on the resurgence of analog computing. Initially, humans were the first computers, manually performing calculations. Mechanical computers with a crank followed. Electronic analog computers used voltages and circuits to compute in the past century. Digital computing appeared in the 1930s, but now there's renewed interest in analog computing due to neural network computations using floating point numbers. Transitioning back to transistors for direct math calculations may create more efficient neural network computers like those in science fiction. Articles and publications like Nature magazine hint at this shift. Analog computing is making a comeback, with promising prospects for the future of computing. Here is Simpson's entire analysis.
This is Simpson Garfinkel for CenterClip, and I want to fill you in on what's happening in the wacky world of analog computing. Now, the very first computers were human, of course. These were people who sat down and cranked through the calculations. But that expression, cranking through the calculations, then refers to the very first mechanical computers, where there was literally a crank that was used to help add numbers together and eventually to multiply them. Things like the Thomson arithmometer from several centuries ago. But then, with the breakthroughs of electronics in a century ago, the very first electronic computers were analog, and they would do math by adding voltages together and moving those voltages through different circuits. And different circuits wired up would produce different computational results. Now, we moved to digital computing in the 1930s because, unlike analog computers, digital computers were less impacted by noise. Nowadays, though, there's a resurgence in interest in analog computing. And that's because a lot of the big computations that are being done now, the neural network computations, they're being done with floating point numbers to simulate analog computing, because they're all based on this mathematical abstraction of a neuron or a perceptron. And several groups are saying, well, why don't we just go back to analog computing? And we can actually use transistors for doing math directly rather than for simulating discrete digital circuits and doing all the math in the digital domain. We can use fewer transistors and yeah, there'll be some noise, but it turns out noise doesn't matter that much with neural computing. And so there are a number of groups trying this and there are circuit designs and there's a lot of interest. If we can get analog computing to work at scale, and use it in modern neural networks, it might create computers that, neural network-based computers, that use much less power than the systems, than the GPU chips that are running things like ChatGPT. And they might actually be faster, and they might be more portable, require less cooling, and it could be a real cybernetic brain in the mode of Isaac Asimov and the pop fiction from the 1950s and 1960s. So it's a very exciting idea, and you'll see little bits and pieces of analog computing coming out here and there. There's an article about analog computing in a February issue of Nature magazine. And but once you start looking for these things, you're going to start to see them all over, because analog computing is making a comeback. That's Simpson Garfinkel for CenterClip.
To round out our countdown this week, Jake Novak joins the Money Clip to analyze what happened in the JetBlue and Spirit merger. This week, JetBlue and Spirit Airlines canceled their merger plans following opposition from regulatory authorities and the Biden administration. Despite losing a court battle to keep the merger alive, the costs associated with pursuing the case further were deemed too high. Novak believes the opposition to the merger was politically motivated. He observes the real threats to the economy lie in powerful monopolies such as Amazon, Google, and hospitals. Amazon's dominance in the retail sector and cloud computing services, Google's control over information access, and hospital consolidation leading to rising healthcare costs are more significant concerns. The focus should be on addressing these major monopolies rather than thwarting potential mergers like JetBlue and Spirit Airlines. Here is the full moment discussing monopolies from Jake Novak.
Hi, I'm Jake Novak, and today we saw JetBlue and Spirit Airlines officially end their hopes for a merger deal. JetBlue had made a good deal to buy out Spirit Airlines, and from the beginning, the regulatory forces in Washington were against this deal. The Biden administration was against it. They lost their fight in court to keep it alive a few months ago. And of course, even when you lose a lower court ruling, you can try to keep it going. But JetBlue and Spirit decided that was just too expensive to do that. I want to talk a little bit about where our antitrust policy is in this country and why it's really hurting not just business, not just the stock market, but it's really hurting Main Street. We do in America have some very dangerous and powerful monopolies that have been enabled by our regulatory powers in this country and our elected leaders for a long time. JetBlue isn't one of them. Now, yes, I agree with the concept that if JetBlue had bought Spirit Airlines, it would have brought airline fares a little bit higher on average. Spirit Airlines is typically the cheapest carrier and you get what you pay for. No offense to the folks at Spirit Airlines, but I'm sorry. No offense to you personally, but honestly, the service at Spirit Airlines is dicey. The boarding process at Spirit Airlines is dicier than other airlines. And that's what you expect when you go on Spirit Airlines. You know what you're getting when you book a flight on Spirit. It's not like they're letting people down so much from what people understand. JetBlue is also a low-cost carrier, but it is a better carrier as far as quality is concerned than Spirit. And yes, you pay a little bit more for that. JetBlue's prices are on average higher. And again, I agree with the argument that if JetBlue had bought Spirit Airlines and swallowed up that airline, we would have seen prices overall go higher because clearly JetBlue would have put their own pricing model into what they're doing at Spirit Airlines, what they would have done at Spirit Airlines. I don't deny that. The thing is that as far as moving the needle in any big way, it wouldn't have done that. You would have seen a small increase in some prices. God, you know, how great would it be if all of the prices that we fly on major carriers were as low as JetBlue? So if JetBlue was going to bring the prices up to their level on Spirit Airlines, that would not have been a very big deal. I believe that there were political reasons for trying to keep Spirit Airlines separate from JetBlue, and that's another discussion, but it wasn't really a major, major concern as far as the American economy was concerned. Now, this all happens at the same time that the same agencies going after the JetBlue-Spirit merger are ignoring some of the monopolies, some of the massive monopolies we have in this country that are much more harmful and are really, really threatening not just our economy, but our American way of life every single day, and already have destroyed many aspects of it. I just want to focus on three really quickly. Amazon, Google, and hospitals. Amazon has destroyed the brick and mortar retail sector in America. Now, not all of that is bad news. There are a lot of things that in retrospect, we should be buying online. It will save us time. It'll save us money, save us energy, all that kind of stuff. The problem is that Amazon has so many other businesses and uses its monopoly in the retail industry to pressure people to go into their cloud computing, to go into some of their other businesses. And this is exactly what we mean when we talk about a monopoly. It's not just the dominance in their main field. It's the fact that they can use that dominance to leverage other fields. Amazon should have been broken up a long time ago, at least when they announced that they were splitting up their headquarters, one in DC and one still back in Washington State. That would have been a very obvious time to do it. It didn't happen, and we're the much the worse for it. Google has become the de facto publisher, only publisher in America. Google has so much power with its search engines and other technology at its fingertips that it is absolutely acting as a de facto censor of a lot of ideas, not just political stuff. I know everyone focuses on that, but other things as well that could really help the economy if they got out there. But Google is basically the only gatekeeper for the majority of Americans on what data and information they see and don't see. And finally, probably the most dangerous of all, hospitals in state after state have been consolidating at a record pace since the mid-90s. We have much fewer choices when it comes to healthcare. The big reason why healthcare costs have gone up, we haven't seen any real major hospital mergers stopped by the federal or state governments. That's the problem, folks, not JetBlue and Spirit Airlines. I'm Jake Novak. Thanks for listening.
We'll have to hold it there. Please remember this episode presents the personal opinions of these individuals and should not be viewed as investment advice. Thank you to Scott Stantis, Jennifer Horn, Simpson Garfinkel, and Jake Novak. For their work and more in real time, please visit centerclip.com. This show has been produced in collaboration with CrossCheck Media Management. CrossCheck redefines family office services with a distinctive blend of financial expertise, media innovation, and alternative investments. One topic at a time, leaders on both sides, always under 5 minutes. That is elevating discourse. Again, centerclip.com for more throughout the week. We'll be back next week. This has been the Weekly Money Clip.
A news story gets shared by a friend on social media, or you catch a tweet that really makes your blood boil. But how do you separate fact from fiction? That's the premise behind Disinformation, a 10-part series from Evergreen Podcasts and Emergent Risk International coming this fall. Tune into Disinformation wherever you get your podcasts, and remember, don't believe everything you read.